Let's start. Now, so I'm talking about the topic of the speech is the economic impact of Australia's ageing population. Australia's population will age markedly over the next 40 years. This is due to both increased longevity and lower fertility, with the latter dating from basically 40 years ago, the end of the baby boom generation and the decline in fertility that we had then. So consequently, there's very little that can be done about the ageing of the population. There's nothing that we can do to prevent these dynamics unfolding. The only choice that we basically have is to adapt. And as the Treasurer is fond of saying, demography is destiny. The economics of the story is a little less certain than the underlying demography. And that's in part because people do have future choices that they can make about their economic behaviour. And in particular, they tend to have an endearing habit of changing their behaviour in ways which make themselves better off. So that means that there's inevitably some uncertainty when we look out over 40 years. But the objective in thinking about the ageing problem is not actually to make a precise economic forecast out over 40 years. That would be an impossible task. Rather, the challenge is to look at a plausible scenario which picks up the major trends that are unfolding and which provides a sound basis for asking the right policy questions. So this is the context for the first and second intergenerational reports which were released in 2002 and earlier this year. And the particular focus was to show how Australia's ageing population and other factors would impact on the economic and fiscal outlook over the next 40 years. Now this chart, the first chart, basically shows the bottom line. The red is the fiscal balance projected in IGR1, the blue is the fiscal balance projected in IGR2, and you can see that there's been an improvement. There's still a deterioration over time because of ageing, but in the last comparable year, the difference in the gap there is about 2 percentage points of GDP. So that's been a substantial improvement over the last 5 years. But even though there has been this improvement in the projected fiscal gap, it would be a mistake, indeed perverse, to think that the challenges of ageing are now behind us. We know that ageing will cause per capita GDP growth to slow, that a sizeable fiscal gap, as you can see in this chart, remains, and that means that the overall burden of government on the economy will rise, and that there will be a need for significant structural change in the economy. It will also be a challenge to hold that strong projected fiscal position, which goes out there, you see the blues, we're still in the surplus on these projections, out to the end of the next decade. It will be a challenge to hold that strong fiscal position over that time period, across several political cycles, I might note. And we also make the obvious point that the deterioration in the fiscal position after that eventually implies a substantial run-up in government debt, again, unless action is taken to address it. So what I'm going to tell you is the story, essentially, of how we get to that chart, which is the bottom line chart in the various IGRs. So we start with the demographics. When population as a whole is analysed, it behaves in a remarkably orderly way. In other words, people are born, they age, and they die in relatively predictable ways. And this means that we can build up a relatively robust picture of the population, given that we know a lot about the people who are alive now, and we can make plausible assumptions about trends in fertility, longevity, and net migration. So, this next chart shows the baseline population projections that are used in the present IGR. The total population is going to go up to a little over 28 million in 2047. And the age profile, which is represented in the coloured bars there, is going to change substantially. The number of children are going to stay broadly the same. That means, relatively speaking, the number of children is going to become a smaller part of the population, and personally I find that a little sad. Children are much more interesting than Treasury officers, incidentally. The population of traditional working age, that is 15 to 64, is going to grow, but it's going to grow much less quickly than the population as a whole. And currently, that traditional working age population cohort is going to fall as a percentage of the total population, in fact, by about 8 percentage points. And the older part of that cohort, in the 55 to 64, is going to be the fastest growing bit of that cohort. And the older you are, the less you work. Then the grey bars, which you can see, are the people over age 65, and in this chart, that's the fastest growing proportion of the population. And again, within that cohort, the older you are, the faster the cohort grows. So that proportion over 65 is going to be around 25% of the population by 2047, basically double what it is now. So just from looking at that chart, you can see that the pattern of supply and demand in the economy is going to shift quite significantly. Just some obvious examples. In the medical profession, paediatrics is not going to be much of a growth industry, but aged care and geriatrics will be. We just had Ian Chubb talking here. It's very clear that demand for education services is not going to come from growth in the cohort of traditional student age population. And the other point to note about this, and this has political implications, the age of the average voter will rise. Now, we are currently experiencing a mini baby boom, and the fertility rate has lifted slightly, but it's still significantly below the replacement rate. Replacement rate's about 2.1 births per female. It's now the fertility rate's now lifted to about 1.8. The fact that we are below replacement rate means that these are the main drivers of the population. You can see that births are just not going anywhere quickly. Deaths gradually rises as the population grows. And the gap between the red and the blue is natural increase. You can see that by the end of this projection period, basically about as many people are going to be dying as they are going to be born. And that means that in terms of the aggregate driver of our population, it is going to be increasingly coming from net immigration. Okay? So that will have some implications for the character of our society, amongst other things. Okay, once we have population, that's the first step in putting the puzzle together. Building up the economic story is actually conceptually quite straightforward. Uncertain, but nevertheless conceptually straightforward. What we need to do is essentially to make assumptions about how much people will work and how productive they will be. This is the so-called 3Ps framework, the population, participation and productivity framework, which projects the economy from the supply side. And because we're looking at the supply side, I'm not going to be talking about economic cycles, just the long-term trends. Now, how much people work is affected in part by how old they are, with participation rates, that is, whether people are involved in the labour force, declining substantially after the age of 55. So an older population will work less in aggregate. And that's the red line there. People aged 15 and over, the participation rate is projected to decline over that period, and quite substantially. Just to explain the blue line quickly, it is the case that we've seen participation rates of all age cohorts increasing in recent years, and importantly for older age cohorts, the participation rates began to lift from about 2001 onwards. But it's nevertheless the case that older workers still work less than younger workers, even though they're working a little more. And so in an economy where there are relatively more older workers and fewer younger workers, the aggregate participation rate declines, even if at any particular age people are working a little more. And so we get this decline in participation, which is in the red line. Because of the improvement that we've seen in participation over the last 5 years or so, that decline is not nearly as significant as we projected in the first IGR report in 2002. Now, there's another layer of detail here to get to aggregate labour input around unemployment and hours worked, but they're both second-order issues, and so I'm not going to dwell on those in any detail. The next point of the puzzle is productivity, and this is a tricky area. In the last 40 years, on an aggregate economy-wide basis, productivity growth was 1.8% per annum. That was essentially what we projected and assumed in IGR 1, and we've done exactly the same thing in IGR 2. So productivity is projected to be at 1.8% per annum over the next 40 years. Now, if we bring all that together, we can get to GDP. The bottom line is that GDP is going to go more slowly over the next 40 years than the last. In the last 40 years, GDP per capita, that is per head, grew by 2.1% per annum. And we are projecting it to grow by 1.6% per annum over the next 40 years. It's not a productivity story, it's all a labour market participation story. The blue is the last 40 years, the red is the next 40 years. What's happening is that, first of all, we're getting a smaller share of the population working. That's that first set of columns. And they're also going to be working a little less hard. And so GDP slows by half a percentage point a year. Now, that doesn't sound like very much, and from year to year it isn't. But over a 40-year period, that's a very significant slowdown. Other things being equal, that means that in 2047, living standards we're projecting to be 20% lower than they otherwise would have been had the ageing effect not come along and slowed labour input into the economy. Now, we can look at this another way. I'm going to build this chart up. On the vertical axis is GDP per hour worked, so that's productivity. On the horizontal axis is average hours worked per person. That's a combination of population and participation. If you multiply those two together, you get GDP. And so the further you go up to the right-hand top corner, the higher is GDP in this chart. The blue is history. Grey is IGR 1, and the red is IGR 2. Now, you can see that there's a turning point there in about 2009, 2010. That's when the great tide of baby boomers who are already beginning to retire becomes an increasing tide. That's when the turning point is in a couple of years. And you can see that the aggregate labour input that is coming is going to decline in that leftward drift over time. Now, you can see two things. One, we're better off than IGR 1, and that's largely because of improved participation of older workers that we've seen in the last 5 years. But equally, it is a very significant decline in labour input. It basically takes us back to the labour input that we saw early in the present economic expansion, about 94, 95. So, question, what does that raise as policy options? Well, the question is, can we improve our participation story, our input into the labour market? This compares Australia, the blue, with a bunch of other OECD countries, the red, and you can see we're kind of, you know, in the middle. I think we're ranked 12 precisely. And there are a number of other countries in there which are significantly higher than us. One which is useful to point out in New Zealand, because it's, you know, typically similar cultural country, they have significantly higher participation rates for both men and women. So there is scope for us to lift our participation rate. If you want to look into the details of this in the back of the IGR, there's some sensitivity analysis which looks at what might happen if our participation rate was lifted. Another way of looking at this is to look at the combination of productivity and participation. This chart is a little bit like the chart of the one before. Again, productivity on the left axis, labour input on the right, on the horizontal axis. The more you go to the top right-hand corner, the higher is GDP. And that plots the position of Australia against other countries right now. So it's a snapshot across a country snapshot. And the red line there shows combinations of productivity and participation which give the same level of GDP as Australia. And you can see that the Netherlands, for example, has pretty much the same level of GDP per head as us, but they do it through higher productivity but lower labour force input. And on the other hand, the United States has a pretty similar labour market input to us, but higher productivity and hence higher and GDP. Now, we're doing pretty well in terms of productivity, if you can see on that chart. But there's still room for improvement. Now, we cannot completely close the gap, say, with the US on the productivity front, because our geography constrains us here because of our small scale and remoteness. But if we could, say, halve that productivity gap with the US, which might be achievable over the longer run, then we'd increase the size of the Australian economy by around 10 percentage points. And again, there is a sensitivity analysis in the IGR which can point you to what the implications of that might be. Just to, again, look very quickly at the global context, this is, of course, not an Australian phenomenon. It's a developed world phenomenon. It's also a China phenomenon. Because of their one-child policy. And as you can see there, Japan is already well into the ageing profile, and that is acting as a significant constraint on their long-run growth already. What does it mean that the world is ageing? Well, just very quickly, I'm not going to get into the details of this. It does mean that it's going to have wide-ranging impacts on global savings behaviour, on asset returns across markets, on international capital flows, and the supply of labour in different regions and hence immigration. Now, working out the precise magnitude of all of that as a global picture is an incredibly difficult exercise, and I'm not going to go into it in detail at all today. There are a vast number of studies which look at this in a global context and run global macroeconometric models and put in assumptions and crank the handle and results pop out at the end. And not surprisingly, the results of those are very diverse, which just shows you how difficult it is. And so we can't actually predict what the impact of the global story is. But there is one clear policy message which emerges from the analysis of these global trends, and that is that countries which have an open and flexible economy with innovative financial markets and opportunities for migration are the ones that are best placed to handle the consequences of demographic change. And in that context, Australia is very well placed compared with some other countries who we often like to compare ourselves with. Getting close now to that first chart I showed you. The fiscal impact is built up by, once we have the economic story, looking at the implications of all of that for the main expenditure categories of government expenditure. And there are the main categories which are driven by ageing, that is health, aged care, age pensions, and in part other income support. If you add all those things together, over the next 40 years, we think that spending by the federal government will increase by about 4.75 percentage points of GDP. which is a very substantial amount. And as I said, they come from health and aged care and so forth. But it's not all a demographic story. A substantial part of the health story is in fact a technology story, and the fact that health is a positive good, and as we get wealthier we will be prepared to spend more on staying healthy and on new drugs and so forth. So if you make an assumption about the tax system, which is made in the IGR, of keeping tax revenue to GDP at the same level, and you add all of those things together, then you get that result. So we end up at the end of that period with a fiscal gap of around about 3.5 percentage points of GDP, compared with the present fiscal position of around 1 percentage point of GDP in surplus. Now, the improvement from that is due, compared with IGR1, is due to a slightly slower rate of spending per person, and that's largely in the health area, and also higher projected nominal GDP, which is in part coming from the present terms of trade boom from high commodity prices. Then we also have higher labour force participation and higher skilled migration that we've seen in recent years. All of that leads to an improvement. Now, the importance, notwithstanding the improvement, the importance of a continuation of policies to support strong economic outcomes is highlighted by the fact that real government spending per person is going to increase as a proportion of GDP. Right? Government is going to be a larger part of the economy on these projections. So government spending is going to increase by 4.7 percentage points from 20.8, which is where we are now, it's the bottom, the end of that blue line, to 25.5, which is the end of the red line. Let me just explain this chart. On the vertical axis is real spending per person. On the horizontal axis is real GDP per person. And those rays that you can see going up there basically plot combinations of real spending and GDP where the size of government is the same. No? Now, as you can see, over the last, you can see the big pickup after 1972-3 in the Whitlam period as the size of government grew very substantially there by about 5 percentage points of GDP quite quickly. And then through the more recent period, we've seen a gradual decline in the share of federal government in GDP. And then as ageing begins to kick in, that will inevitably rise. And basically, you can deconstruct that. That is because real GDP goes up by, in the projection period, 86%. That is the arrow to the right. And spending goes up by 128%. Hence the share rises. Spending goes up by faster than GDP. Now, it's impossible to be definitive about the optimal size of government. I'm afraid that presses economic science just a little too far. And this is a very complex and subtle area which I don't have time to get into in any depth today, but the bottom line is that theory and empirical research, particularly by the OECD, which has looked across countries, lends support to the notion that government expenditure and the taxes which are required to finance it have a negative impact on efficiency as governments become larger. Okay, and similarly, it does appear that a larger government is associated with slower growth. That's on average across country studies. Given that, it's reasonable to think that Australia has been well served by having a general government sector that is relatively small and stable compared with other OECD countries. And we also know that in a fully employed economy, increasing the size of government must crowd out the private sector over time. Hence, All of this serves to underline the desirability of limiting the projected slowdown in real GDP growth over the coming 40 years by lifting both productivity from its historical average and further reducing the barriers to participation. It also underlines the need to be vigilant about pressures to increase real spending per capita and the overall share of government in the economy. And this is the policy challenge thrown up by the IGR. Thank you.